Welcome back to In the Moment. From unity in the state Republican Party to an even bigger budget crunch in the state budget, all eyes remain on state politics during this legislative session. Today's Dakota political junkies are Roger Whittle, he's managing editor of the Watertown Public Opinion, and Jonathan Ellis, he's a reporter and columnist for the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Let's get started. Jonathan Ellis, welcome back to In the Moment.
Hey, Lori, how's it going?
Doing all right. How about you, sir?
It's nice and sunny out there.
You can't beat that, can you?
Yeah.
Roger Whittle, thanks for being here as well.
My pleasure.
All right, how is it in Watertown? Nice and sunny?
It's also beautiful. It's we don't know what to do with ourselves up here.
Good day for a polar plunge?
Actually, we did have a good day for one this weekend, much better than the last couple of years has been.
That doesn't take quite as much courage to jump in the water on
it.
On that particular February. You had a famous guest as well.
We did. Our Congresswoman Kristi Noem participated in her first ever polar plunge and donned a camouflaged full body wetsuit sort of looking thing and jumped into a hole in Lake Compesca. It was almost 40. It was around 40 degrees though, so it wasn't bad. The last couple of years I've had it has actually been below zero. So
she got
off pretty easily.
Yeah, well, for the first time, you don't want to make it too miserable for folks. Let them have some fun. They'll come back and then trick them next time with the 10 degrees below zero. So, all right, let's dig into the serious stuff and let's start out with the state GOP has a new chair. And that's Dan Lederman. He was on the show the other day. And I wanted to start out with a little clip from my conversation with him. Here he's talking about unity in the state GOP.
The Republican Party is very unified. I get asked that question a lot because I think that there's a narrative that there's an issue with a division, but there isn't. What I saw on Saturday was a very unified party that's already pulled together. There may be differences in enthusiasm. Some may be more enthusiastic. Some just want to kind of carry on the banner as they have for years. But I really see a great party that has, now we have 85% of the legislative seats in Pierre, and we control every statewide elected office. Donald Trump received a larger percentage of vote than any presidential candidate I can remember, going back to Reagan. So we're just going to continue building on that. That unity is there.
All right, Jonathan, let's start with you. Is there a narrative that says the state Republican Party is not as unified as, is that narrative false?
Well, I mean, there have always been divisions. There always will be divisions. This was a defeat actually for the governor's office. The fact that Dan Lederman is the chairman, and so there was certainly a division among what the governor and probably some of the governor's supporters what they wanted in terms of a chairman. So yeah, I mean there are divisions, but that's not in itself a news story necessarily because there have always been divisions. It's just a matter of whether or not they can work together, the different factions of the Republican Party. There's certainly divisions within the Democratic Party as well. Really, to me, the news here is that the governor's pick for chairman of the party, which for as far as I know, forever, the governor has always sort of had the chairman. Has been able to select the chairman, or the governor's pick has been voted in to be the chairman. That did not happen. And that was really very historic, and so it says a little bit about where the governor's political standing is in my mind with his own party right now.
Roger, what are your thoughts? Obviously, the governor's pick was Pam Roberts. She was the incumbent. The vote was 73-53 for Dan Lederman. What does it say about the governor's standing?
Well, and it's not just the governor. I've heard. Pam Roberts was also the choice of our delegation in Washington to lead the party back home. But, like Jonathan said, there's a difference between strength and unity. There's always going to be divisions in parties, but I don't think that what happened here necessarily weakens the party overall. I mean, it's still a dominant force in South Dakota politics. And I don't think at this point who is the chairman is going to change that much.
All right. Jonathan, let's talk about the state budget a little bit next. Things are even tighter than expected.
Well, yeah, and I think it's only going to get, potentially it's going to get worse. I mean, I think they're looking at trying to fill, 50-some million dollars over the next two budget cycles. I mean, the farm economy is extremely soft, and I think that that's contributing a lot to this. The question I think a lot of people have is also how much sales revenue is the state actually losing to internet sales, and that's obviously a fight that they're carrying out in the judicial system. So, I mean, lean times, the governor, faced some pretty drastic budget situations when he came into office, and since then, I mean, the state budget has grown pretty nicely, pretty conservatively over the last several years, and sort of now we're back into this time period where they're going to have to find some places to cut. So, I mean, it happens, but it's been a few years since we've been down this road.
All right, Roger, lean times. This is a governor who knows how to deal with lean times. What comes next?
Well, he'll probably do pretty much what he did last time and just ask every department to cut back. One thing they've already taken away is his plan to make Spearfish Canyon a state park. Just a couple hours ago, the Legislative Joint Committee on Appropriations tabled his request for $2.5 million for that project, which I think had some other problems besides financial, but I think you're going to see any new money that comes before the Appropriations Committee is going to have a very difficult time getting through this session because of those soft sales tax numbers.
Jonathan, were you following the Spearfish Canyon conversation at all? Is this sort of a saved by the bell as far as not having to discuss it anymore? It sits on the table?
To the little extent that I had been following it, and obviously I'm not out there, but the governor's office did request that it be tabled, but there, as Roger indicated, there were some other issues going on with that, and there was some controversy surrounding it. I mean, there was some criticism of it, so it'll be interesting to see if it comes back.
Right. All right, Roger, what else are you watching here as we approach the middle of this session now? What jumps out at you? What do you want to talk about next?
Well, I think we can always talk about the IM-22. That's a
right.
That seems to be a favorite. We had a Cracker Barrel up here on Saturday, and it was a big topic there. The senators and representatives are putting on a united face, saying, we did what we did. We did the right thing. We can sleep at night, but there's still a lot of anger among the voters out there who see the lawmakers taking what they passed and just immediately killing it and starting over. So I think we're going to see that still permeate things the rest of the session.
And Jonathan, does it permeate things beyond the session? I've heard some people talking about political consequences of that, and I'm not sure I'm ready to go that far. Do you think there will be political consequences of how IM-22 was handled by individual lawmakers?
I mean, they are putting in place some of the some replacement measures with regard. I think yesterday was some restrictions on lobbyists, which I think South Dakota might be the only state in the country without those. So there was some reporting requirements there. I mean, that was part of IM-22, the part about the ethics commission. So they're replacing parts of it. And that could very well appease a lot of voters. It won't appease the people who put it on the ballot, and that specifically would be the likes of Rick Wyland and Democratic supporters there. So I don't think anything can appease them, and certainly it will be up to them to make the repeal have some repercussions for that, political repercussions. Now, I'll say this. I mean, I'm going back to 1996 when the legislature. I mean, this has happened before. I mean, all of the indignation. I mean, I'm a little. I have to kind of yawn at it a little bit because this has happened before. In 1996, the legislature repealed something immediately thereafter. It was very popular. It was passed by a much wider margin than IM-22 was, and there were absolutely no political consequences for that. So just going based on history, I would have to say that probably, I mean, we have another entire legislative session. People start to forget about what happened. I'm going to guess that there won't be political consequences, but you're also dealing with some savvy people who put this on the ballot, and they have a way of perhaps making it come back to haunt some of these lawmakers. But I, right now, if I had to bet, I would say probably not.
Jonathan, I'm going to remember that forever, that you yawn at indignation. That's what, what a T-shirt. I yawn at your indignation. So
it's just maybe it's just I'm on Twitter. I mean, it's just everywhere. Right? You're just like, go away.
Enough already.
Yeah.
Roger, what about this whole notion of outside money coming in to support things like Marcy's Law, to support Initiated Measure 22, and the struggle to sort of limit that outside money? Is that a new effort?
As far as I know, it's fairly new. I haven't been back in the state that long, but a lot of
people seems like you are, you know? It just seems like you just have this deep, I always ask you questions, you're like, well, I haven't been here that long.
Well, I was born
the wisdom.
I was born and raised in South Dakota and then moved away for 35 years.
All right.
But, you know, it's a difficult thing to control how people spend their money. That's not really something that the government can do. I mean, they tried it before and it doesn't really work. On the other hand, it is, you know, everybody says it's a problem when out-of-state groups pour millions and millions of dollars into the state to get these initiated measures passed. It's a fine line there to walk, and I don't know what the legislator can do to stop it. I know there are some efforts going on right now, and maybe Jonathan can expand on those a little bit to limit that kind of out-of-state money, but when it comes down to it, I'm not sure that they legally can.
Jonathan?
Well, that's the issue I think that's going to play out. I mean, the legislature is in the process of passing or, you know, some campaign finance measures that would limit out-of-state money, and undoubtedly, I think they've already acknowledged the fact that they're going to see some legal challenges to this, and so it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting from my perspective to see, you know, Republican lawmakers suddenly trying to clamp down on cash. You know, that's just not typically something that one sees in our political process. So, that they're suddenly worried about all this cash flowing into the state or whatever. It's not the first time that we've seen big amounts of cash coming into the state for ballot issues. I mean, that's happened before. I mean, I look at the 06, 08 campaigns on the on abortion. There have been some other big ones that have brought in out-of-state cash. So, but I think what's happening here is Democrats have really figured out how to play the game. I mean, they know that, you know, at least in the electoral politics right now, they're kind of down and out a little bit, but they've learned how to play. You know, I talked about, you know, Rick Wyland and, you know, Dre Samuelson, you know, longtime chief of staff to Senator Tim Johnson. I mean, they figured out how to play politically, and that does involve sometimes using the resources and allies of like-minded groups outside of the state of South Dakota on bringing those resources here. So they've figured out how to have a presence politically through the initiated measure process, and now suddenly you see Republicans like, oh, we can't have all this cash. Well, and so anyway, I just can't think of a time politically where you've had Republicans worried about cash flowing into campaigns. So
are we an affordable state to sort of test things out in? Is that what's really at the root of this, Roger?
Well, we are an affordable state. I really don't know if we're a testing ground for that. I think these national groups are pouring their money wherever they can, wherever they think they can make a change, and it just doesn't cost as much to do it in South Dakota.
All right. Roger Whittle, managing editor of the Watertown Public Opinion. Thanks, Roger.
Thank you. Thanks, Jonathan.
Is that it, Lori? We're done?
Well, do you want to yawn at some more indignation? You want to keep going, Jonathan?
Let's stop
that music right now, mister, and we'll turn this car around and we'll keep going.
I'm going to go for a run. So
all right.
Thank you.
Jonathan is a reporter, columnist with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Thanks, Jonathan. A bill that changes the penalty for some abortions is halfway through the State House. Yesterday, members of the South Dakota House of Representatives passed a measure that makes it a felony for a doctor to perform an abortion when the fetus can feel pain. SDPB's Keely Boltina covers health issues for South Dakota Public Broadcasting. She joins us live now from Sioux Falls to talk about House Bill 1101. Keely, welcome.
Thanks, Lori.
Tell me what the bill does versus how our world exists as we know it today.
1 year ago, lawmakers passed a measure that makes it a Class 1 misdemeanor to perform an abortion or attempt to perform an abortion on a pain-capable fetus. The measure in 2016 put into state law that fetuses feel pain at 20 weeks along. It has an exception for medical emergencies, and it also does not criminalize the woman seeking an abortion. This bill, House Bill 1101, changes that Class 1 misdemeanor to a Class 6 felony.
So how does the penalty change then if someone is convicted?
Misdemeanors are considered less serious crimes than felonies. And within those, the higher the class, the more serious the offense. So in South Dakota, a Class 1 misdemeanor comes with a maximum of $2,000 in fine and a year in prison. A Class 6 felony doubles that. So 2 years in prison and a $4,000 fine.
So again, Healy, that would be for the physician or the health care provider, not for the woman.
Right, for the doctor.
Mm-hmm. All right. So if this was just passed last year, why the change now?
There's some confusion about that. State Representative Steve Haugard is the prime sponsor of House Bill 1101. And on the floor yesterday, he said that making the penalty a felony aligns it with the rest of state law. But he also said that the misdemeanor was inadvertent. And then State Representative Ray Ring challenged him on that because in committee last year, that bill started out with a felony charge and then lawmakers specifically amended it to be a misdemeanor. And so for his part, Haugard said he may have misspoken and that he didn't go back and listen to last year's testimony. I did, and it was certainly a direct decision to switch that from a felony to a misdemeanor last session. In practice, a Planned Parenthood representative says that the organization's doctors do not perform abortions past the first trimester in South Dakota, so this doesn't actually affect their day-to-day services. And one lawmaker on the floor yesterday asked how many doctors have been charged with the misdemeanor, and the prime sponsor said he suspects no charges have been filed in the last year since this became law.
And then the conversation yesterday veers off topic toward the end of the debate, really into the morality and the controversy of abortion itself, correct?
Right. So the bill itself is pretty simple. But at the end of the debate on House Bill 1101, prime sponsor State Representative Steve Haugard, he called abortion reprehensible. And then he said this.
I can tell you that in the Sioux Falls area, having the one abortion clinic that's most notable, the Planned Parenthood facility, they advised in the past several weeks someone who is seeking an abortion that they were so booked up that that person should probably go to the cities to seek an abortion because they didn't have the time to get them into the schedule. And I suspect that isn't just for people who have been the victim of rape or the one who's suffering some sort of a medical situation that compromises the pregnancy. These are abortions of convenience.
Now, Keely, I know you, and I know you were going to fact check that. So is it true? Is Planned Parenthood so busy with abortions that people can't get in?
Well, I asked Tim Stanley, who is the senior director of government and public affairs for Planned Parenthood in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. He says he can't speak directly to exactly what that lawmaker may have heard from someone else, but he does say that laws restricting abortions may make it harder for women to get the procedure.
At Planned Parenthood in Sioux Falls, we are a family planning clinic. We're a women's health clinic. We're an abortion clinic, and we provide each patient with compassionate, expert care and scientifically accurate information so they can make the decision that's best for them and their families. It would not be uncommon due to perhaps a scheduling situation or for the individual woman and her family's situation that we may refer somebody to the Twin Cities, but I would by no means say that that is the norm. The clinic in Sioux Falls is very busy, but it's because of our thriving family planning and birth control clinic as well as abortions being performed there.
Now, yesterday, lawmakers approved House Bill 1101 by a vote of 58-8. So the measure itself goes to the state Senate for consideration. Keely, what about other abortion legislation this session?
We have House Bill 1189 that's filed. That prohibits dismemberment abortions. Supporters have in the past said that those are violent and gruesome acts. Now, we do know that NARAL Pro-Choice South Dakota has come out against the move, saying it's the safest method for abortions in the second trimester, and those are not elective procedures. They are in emergencies where people, where lives are at risk. But we'll see. House Bill 1189 is assigned to the Judiciary Committee on the House side, but it has not had a hearing.
SDPB's Keely Beltina, thanks for sticking around with the schedule today and bringing us news from Pierre.
You're welcome.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Korzhak Jolkovsky was already well known in Boston when he received a letter from Chief Henry Standing Bear asking the artist to consider carving a mountain to honor a chief. The story that unfolded transformed the people involved and continues to make history in South Dakota and beyond. You can hear Dr. Jeff Waring present Who is the Reluctant Celebrity? It's at 1:30 and 4 p.m. Mountain Time at the Black Hills State University Spearfish campus. Jeff Waring joins us on the phone now from Spearfish. Jeff, hi. Welcome to In the Moment.
Hi, good morning.
Let's start with this word reluctant, and give me an idea of how this idea of looking at reluctance in this story first sort of bubbled up for you.
Yeah, so I started looking at, you know, the role of these different men, you know, in this creation of the memorial, right? And so Chief Henry Standing Bear came up with this idea to create a memorial, but needed an expert artist to actually do it, right? The problem is that, you know, here you have this transplant in Korchak who's coming down from Boston, right, not associated with the native people at all, and kind of stuck into this, you know, cultural phenomenon. And, you know, for him as a white man to be the figurehead didn't really make sense and kind of brought up a lot of controversy. And so, you know, he had some reluctance there to be the celebrity overseeing the project.
Huh. Tell me about him as an artist before this time. He's from Boston. He's well known. What's he well known for doing?
Well, so, you know, he did a lot of art in the area, so sculptures, so local sculptures within towns. Really, he had just won this big national contest. And so that's where Chief Henry Standing Bear found out about him. And I'm forgetting the name of the contest offhand, but he had won this national contest, and I think it was at the World's Fair or something. And so he was getting all this press. He had also done some things along with, you know, he had come down to South Dakota and done something with Borglum, you know, who was doing Mount Rushmore. And so he was slightly known in the area, but it was more from the newspaper that Standing Bear knew him.
All right. So who's Chief Henry Standing Bear?
So he was basically a local Indian who, you know, had this idea that he, you know, wanted to honor his people. And he was a relative of Crazy Horse and said, hey, you know, this would be a good way to honor, you know, honor our people as a whole by creating a memorial to Crazy Horse. And it was really actually important that he was a relative of Crazy Horse because in the culture, you know, you couldn't do something like this just, you know, out of the blue. You had to be related somehow. And so that's why that was important of who he was as a relative.
So does it start out as this idea of what you see when you drive to Custer today? And was it supposed to be as big as it currently is?
Well, so that's actually what I think is so interesting. I don't know for sure, but I don't think Standing Bear had that grand of a vision, right? He wasn't comparing it to like Mount Rushmore. He was comparing it to some of the smaller statues and memorials that have been done across the country. And, you know, he just wanted something there. And I think that Korchak is really the one who started having this grander vision, right? So, you know, this vision of having the largest memorial in the world and then actually going beyond that. And I think that's where the story gets really interesting is Korchak didn't see the memorial as being an end in itself.
Let's talk about that a little bit. What does he's obviously thinks big. And but then he thinks beyond just the mountain itself. Tell me.
Yeah, so Korchak views the mountain as a way to get people to learn about the culture, but also as a way to kind of raise money and support to ultimately put in a museum and a cultural center, which is there now. And then a university, which they've actually created the university. I look at it as the other reluctant celebrity. And ultimately, someday, a medical training center. And so Korchak had this bigger vision of this whole campus on the site that's to actually kind of lift up the Native people today and in the future. And that went way beyond what Henry Standing Bear originally envisioned.
All right, I missed what you said. There was another reluctant celebrity. Who was that?
Yeah, so I look at the other reluctant celebrity being the university. So, the university actually has started on the site, and it's the Indian University in North America. And, it started up. They've been pushing it since 2010. They've had this going on as a summer program. And not many people know about it. So I talk to my students, and they just think about this giant mountain being carved. And they don't realize that, yes, this other part of the vision to create a university has already begun. And, they've had, 189 students who have gone through the program already. And yet we don't know about it. We don't hear about it.
What kind of university is it? What kind of program are they teaching?
So they have classes. They have algebra, speech, composition. So all of these courses that you would have your first semester in college, they provide them for these largely Native students the summer before they would start college. So basically getting one semester under their belt before they get started at a traditional college. The advantage is it's very intensive in terms of academic advising and getting them ready, for all their future courses. And so there's a lot of college success prep that goes into it as well.
And this is this is Korchak's idea?
Yeah, and that's the amazing thing. So,
yeah.
and people don't know about it. And
no.
So I look at this as like it's this hidden gem. And so, he talked about it in the press. The first, earliest instance I found was 1957. When he mentioned it in the press. But there's actually a letter that Korchak wrote to Standing Bear back in 1950 where he mentions it. And so it's like, it blew my mind. Here I was thinking, this is a great idea for this university center, but, it must be a new idea. And then I keep going back further and further through the records, and I'm finding these references to it. So obviously Korchak had this bubbling up from the beginning, and it's just finally coming to fruition, 50, 60 years later.
And is it physically located by the memorial?
It is, yes.
It is.
It's located
right
at the memorial. They received some donations to build an actual building with dormitories and then the classrooms.
So what's his sort of relationship with education, higher education, that becomes, a person who's not from here, who doesn't have a lot of Native American connections, and he comes up with that?
Yeah, well, he was, Korchak was a big proponent of education and on continual learning and reading. And, they're at the memorial site. There is an awesome library down in the basement, for use by the students. And they have, the family has a personal library. And, just really there's this whole mentality of education being incredibly important that has been fostered through Korchak and his family. And so this is just part of it. Sharing that with the Native people.
And are you finding in your research any thoughts back from Chief Henry Standing Bear or others that supported Korchak's early ideas about a university at the site?
That's interesting. I haven't seen anything from other people talking about it. It's mainly just quotes from Korchak. It seems to me that, Standing Bear was very much focused on just, let's build this memorial and, maybe talk to tourists and share the culture a bit. But this grander vision this was Korchak's vision.
How does he sort of change as a person then, as a man, from an artist from Boston to who he becomes later in his life? Talk about his path a little bit.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of him, like before and after pictures. It is an incredible physical change, right? So he starts out as this, skinny little, almost upper-class looking guy, right? Where you'd expect him to be going to fancy parties and all that.
Right.
And over time becomes this mountain man. And, so this physical change, I think, is representative of what happened to him personally. He became very focused. This was his life. He went from doing all these little projects to like one project that was going to consume the rest of his life.
Really?
And it's funny, as I read, I read a lot of letters that he wrote, and man, it's, I wish I could have met him.
Yeah.
Actually, I wish I could have met him back in the 40s and then met him again, you know, later on in his life, just to be able to experience that change.
So tell me about his letters some then. What kind of writer is he?
Insanely blunt.
Really?
yeah, no, he did not pull back. And actually, a lot of the letters that I read are written by his wives. So his first wife, Dorothy, or his later wife, Ruth, they wrote a lot of the letters. And I think it's because when Korchak wrote to people, I mean, he didn't hold back. It was just, this is what it is, you know, let's move. I mean, yeah. Very much focused on being productive, getting the work done, you know, none of this being political and being nice and flowy. He just wanted to get right to the point.
And what did he want to get done? The sculpture itself? Is that what he's really is occupying his time?
Yeah, I think that actually did occupy most of his time during his life, was getting that done. He dealt with, it's amazing how much politics he had to deal with. And I could tell that he hated dealing with it, but he had to deal with, you know, things going on with the state. And didn't like that. So he wanted to focus on the art.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment. My guest is Dr. Jeff Waring. He's from Black Hills State University. He's going to give a talk called Who is the Reluctant Celebrity? You can see that twice, actually, at Black Hills State Spearfish campus today at 1:30 and 4 p.m. Mountain Time. Jeff, I'm wondering about this medical center then. Is that something that's in development still? I haven't heard of that either.
Yeah, so they have not made progress, as I've seen announced at least, regarding the medical center. It's really, the statement is, it's when it's practical. So, you know, it's still there in the plans, you know, long term. And if you look at on site, they have a big, you know, diorama of what the site will hopefully eventually look like, and it's in the plans, but it's when practical. And so they're being very deliberate with what steps to take so that they can offer, you know, really good services. And so that's not actually, I guess, the University Medical Training Center is not moving forward. It's the university and the pre-college class that's the thing that we're really focusing on.
What was his vision for it? Was he thinking it's a place to receive medical training or to receive medical care? When he sort of planned it out, what was his vision for a medical center at this memorial site?
Yeah, and so I don't know. That's interesting. He talked a lot more about the university and what he wanted to get out of the university. From what I've seen, it used to be referenced, you know, a long time back, he would reference it as a medical center. And then over time, they kind of changed the language to be medical training center.
Okay.
And so I don't know if it was meant to be like a, you know, a teaching hospital or what the original vision was. But it was there, like, you know, the verbiage there of having a medical center has been there all along.
So Korchak lives in South Dakota then until his death. When did he die? I don't remember right now.
Oh, man, I am forgetting.
Yeah, we're both going to be stumped
well.
By that, yeah. So yeah. That's okay.
it's been a while. So, yeah. You know, it's been a couple decades, and his wife, Ruth, basically took over running everything up until she passed 2 years ago now.
Okay.
And so, you know, that was an interesting thing, is when Korchak passed away, they very smoothly passed a transition to Ruth taking over. I think she was actually doing a lot of the management before he passed, and so it was easy for her to take over, become the celebrity for the site, and keep it running.
Is she reluctant, or she's ready to step into that role?
I don't know. I think she was ready to step in.
Yeah.
I think she had been doing a lot of it for so long that she knew what she was doing. I mean, everything I have heard talking to people on the site is that she was just an amazing, powerful woman and could do about anything. Yeah. And so, they made that transition very nice and clean for Ruth taking over. As Ruth passed, now there's three women who have taken over and are running it jointly. So two of their daughters, as well as one outside person who came in to run it. And so it's really, it seems like it's a great team effort now to run the whole site.
Now, did you grow up around here? Are you from South Dakota?
I'm not. I'm from Pennsylvania.
All right. So you came west as well. Do you kind of feel how do you sort of look at this memorial as, you know, its a role in tourism in the state, its role in business, its role in art and culture? What are your thoughts when you first saw that mountain for the first time?
Well, so, you know, I was initially interested in it just because I love big things, right? So I love these projects that just seem so unbelievable. And this idea of, like, you know, what can we do as human beings? And, you know, that's what initially drew me to it. I think it has a huge draw for tourists. I think it brings a lot of people back to the state because they come and they see Mount Rushmore. They get home and then somebody says, well, did you see Crazy Horse while you were out there? And so I think it gets a lot of repeat tourists for the state, which is great. In terms of art, I actually know very little about art. I think it does the whole site. The museum is wonderful, and the cultural center for helping people to understand the culture of the native people. And, you know, it's funny. I don't send as many people there as I would like because everyone's like, oh, can I do it in 2 hours? And I'm like, no. Like,
no.
if you only have 2 hours, you go see Mount Rushmore. If you're going to go in and, you know, visit the Crazy Horse site, you really need a half a day. I mean, just to be able to see it. And so I think that's the thing. There's so much there. And, I mean, man, I've made 20 trips there before I saw everything. So
Jeff Waring presents Who is the Reluctant Celebrity? You can see him today in the Jacket Zone at 1:30 and again at 4 p.m. in Jonas on the Black Hill State University campus. That's in Spearfish. Jeff, thanks so much. It's been a true pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The simple rules of two-dimensional paper folding blossom around us in nature, from the petals of a flower to the wings of a beetle. Now those principles of origami are inspiring a scientific revolution. Tonight on SDPB-TV, tune in for NOVA's The Origami Revolution. It airs at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain. And joining us now for more is a MIT mathematician who's featured in the film. His name is Eric Demain. Eric, welcome to In the Moment.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, let's get started because this is pretty exciting stuff. And origami is a centuries-old tradition, but the revolution is happening now. How come?
There's been a big growth in our mathematical and computational understanding of how paper folds, and that's led to a new spur in engineering and science applications.
So when did you first, you've been interested in math for a long time, when were you first sort of making, because this is geometry, right? It begins with sort of basic tenets of geometry, right?
Yeah. When I was just starting out as a PhD student in the mid-90s, I guess, I knew I liked geometry and I was looking for interesting problems to solve. And this new world of computational origami was just getting started. There were like one or two papers in the field. I thought, oh, that sounds like fun. I was just a mathematician and thought it would be a neat thing to do, and had no idea it would have so many applications later on.
So explain to me how computational origami works at its core.
The general idea is to have a computer help design new folded structures. So like the kind of classic origami design problem is I give you a shape that I'd like to fold, and then the computer algorithm will tell you how to fold it.
And what were some of the first applications that you thought it might be used for? Well, how did it capture your imagination, other than just being a problem you wanted to untangle?
Right. Initially, the application was just to make cooler origami art,
right?
And it certainly had that impact. There's been a lot of new origami artists, even non-mathematical and non-computational people still use the same kinds of ideas to improve their art. But I've always imagined that it would have some applications to manufacturing, and that's starting to happen, where instead of folding out of paper, maybe you fold out of sheet metal or plastic, which leads to some challenges. We're figuring out how to deal with more thicker material, but that would let you make much stronger engineered structures that are still very lightweight because we can fold them out of thin sheets and use sheet material.
I want to talk a little bit about your partner that's featured in this film, Tomohiro Tachi. Am I saying it right?
Yes.
Okay, and tell me about his teapot.
It's
yeah, remarkable.
I met Tomohiro several years ago now. He was still a PhD student, and he was visiting Boston at a conference called SIGGRAPH, and at the art exhibit there, he showed this new way to fold a teapot. Teapot is a classic model in computer graphics, and it's a very complicated model. It has a handle, so it's topologically complicated. It has a lot of undercuts and reflex angles, and no one had ever folded anything like that out of paper. And he arrived with this model, and I was looking at it, I was like, whoa, this is really weird and different. Doesn't look like any computational origami design we've done before. And he had sort of done it by hand, sort of computing it by hand, but then he had an idea for how to generalize it to arbitrary surfaces. And so we've been working on it for the last 9 or 10 years, proving that this method, which we call Origamizer, always can fold anything. You give it any 3D model you want, and it will tell you exactly how to fold it from a square of paper.
So you're searching for a universal proof.
Right.
And it takes how long?
Well, the algorithm is pretty fast, but then to fold the crease pattern that it results can take a long time. Currently, we're folding by hand, and complicated models can take like 10 hours to fold.
Okay, so you can take anything 3D and try to figure out how to translate it on the computer to a single sheet of material, say paper.
Right.
And then print out a crease pattern. Am I understanding that? Am I getting the steps right?
Yep,
because
exactly.
It's not my area of expertise.
And then fold along all the lines.
Yeah.
And then you collapse all of those creases at once. That's the tricky part. And you get exactly the 3D thing you asked for.
And you still are doing that part by hand. That's still human beings still doing the folding.
Right. Which is fun. But
yeah.
Certainly one of the goals is to make the folding happen automatically. There's an easy first step, which people do a fair amount, which is to use a computer-controlled knife blade or laser to score the creases ahead of time. So
okay.
That part, that saves a lot of time, because folding along all those lines is kind of tedious, but you still have to do the 3D folding part by hand. But we're also exploring other materials that you can embed into the paper that when you heat it up or shine a light on it or things like that, then the creases fold themselves. And that would be a lot more practical for a lot of applications, and you don't need the origamist there sitting and folding for 10 hours.
Now you're an artist as well.
Right.
Tell me about your art.
Yeah, so I do a lot of folded paper art with my father, Martin Demain. And that's mostly exploring curved crease folding. So we have all these algorithms for designing origami using straight line folds, and most origami uses straight line folds. But curved creases are kind of new and exciting mystery because we don't really understand how they work mathematically.
Hmm.
And so until we understand them, my dad and I have been making lots of sculpture that sort of explores what's possible by curved crease folding.
So your understanding as an artist is steps ahead of your understanding as a mathematician in that
right.
regard.
Yeah. So the hope is that by making lots of sculpture, we've been growing intuition for how curved creases work, and the hope is that intuition will feed into our mathematics, and it's started to. We're starting to understand more and more about how curved creases work.
It's beautiful. You can find, some examples of this online in a gallery. We'll put a link up after our show so folks can see your artwork with your father. Did he teach you this? Do you sort of learn it together?
We've known each other a long time.
Right.
and my dad actually homeschooled me up until college. But then I sort of took off and learned mathematics and computer science mostly on my own. And my dad's background is in the arts. When I started working in computational origami, he thought it was kind of cool because it was taking an art form and studying it mathematically. And that intrigued him. And then he learned to become a mathematician as well.
Really?
It was only fair that I become an artist and join the other side.
Do you see geometric patterns in nature all around you every day? Is that something that just sort of leaps out at you?
Yeah, whenever I see something cool in real life, I'm always trying to imagine, I wonder how could we study that mathematically and how can we extract the geometry and kind of distill it down to a nice math problem. Huh. Origami was one natural setting, but I hope there will be more.
So in this NOVA special, if you're just tuning in, my guest is Eric Demain. He's an artist. He's a mathematician from MIT, a professor. We're talking about tonight's NOVA presentation of the Origami Revolution. You can see that at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV. And Eric, throughout this documentary, there's applications in biomedicine, protein engineering, manufacturing, space exploration, all kinds of things. Who inspires you in this field right now with the next sort of steps of origami? Is it the artists? Is it the engineers? Where are you kind of excited to go next?
It's all inspiring.
Right.
Probably the biggest action right now is in the engineering side, using origami design techniques to come up with new engineering products. I saw a new one, one that was new to me in this documentary, for building a deployable shield for police officers so they can carry a very lightweight and compactly folded object that unfolds and becomes a bulletproof shield, which is really cool.
Origami out of Kevlar. And
yeah, exactly.
Fascinating stuff, yeah.
I'm also really excited about the applications to robotics, making... it's sort of a new way to make robots. The traditional way is 3D parts, millions of parts and millions of dollars,
yeah.
Thousands of parts, millions of dollars. And the new approach is just one flat part that can fold into your complicated robot for on the order of $20. And it can even fold itself into that 3D shape. And it could really change the way we think about making robots, because now you can make a new iteration on your design every day instead of having to wait years to come up with a new design.
A mind-expanding conversation. The art is beautiful, and the NOVA documentary is remarkable. Eric Demain is featured in that documentary tonight. It's called The Origami Revolution, 7 Mountain, 8 Central. Eric, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And now if you listen over 88.3 FM, KESD is going to be shut off by 1 for about an hour for tower maintenance. Thanks for your patience. And we got something wrong. The Black Hills State Speaker is tomorrow, not today.